It's Saturday, April 30th, 2011, 10:06 a.m. in the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news with a full house and also news about the royal wedding. Just kidding. It is time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Rick Philman is on vacation, and so we won't be taking calls this hour, but we do have a full host of geeks ready to wow you with their technical expertise and, well, hopefully, their brilliance. Anyway, welcome to Geek Speak. Once again, I am Miles Elam. In the air room with me are Al Luckow, new media architect.
Hello, everybody.
Alex Salias, application security analyst.
Good morning, Miles.
And unfortunately, I skipped over just by accident. Don't take it personally. Laurel Klein, developer relations.
Hi there.
And Lindsay Lonnie, systems analyst.
Good morning, geeks.
Uh-oh, I'm not hearing anything from that mic. I have you turned on.
But you do?
Yeah. Let's try mic 5.
Good morning, geeks.
Oh,
very nice.
You told me the wrong one.
Oh, well, it's labeled wrong then. I'm not wrong.
Never.
Ever.
First, a quick follow-up to last week's show, which was on passwords. The last caller we had her passwords all written in a document on the computer, and we didn't have enough time to actually cover that other than to just say, oh, don't do that, because the response that we got from her was that she wasn't in an office, she's not on a large network where people are just walking by and can see that information, which has some merit, except for the fact that if you have something like jewelry or something of value, chances are you have a home safe, you know, especially, you know, either for fire or for burglary. Now, think of everything that you would have put in a safe, anything the value of yours, if you have one. Now, think of everything that your computer has access to on the web, your bank accounts, the ability to purchase items on Amazon or any of the other e-commerce sites.
So you should put your computer in a safe.
Excellent.
So your passwords, if they are on your computer, chances are if someone were to steal a computer, because times are changing, they may have access to all of that information that your computer has access to if your passwords are readily available on that box. So it really does make sense to lock it down, just as a public service announcement to pull over from last week's show. But this is a new week. This is a whole new topic, a whole new series of topics. And to go on with that nice little change of pace, let's start with Al Luckow.
Okay. Well, speaking of burglary...
okay, it's not a change of pace.
Yeah. I found this neat little thing on the web. It's a website, and this is all free, and it's called Stolen Camera Finder. Now, it's really a neat idea. The way it works is every time you take a picture, most cameras, most new digital cameras, use this thing, this attachment called the EXIF information. It's embedded in the photo. EXIF is it stands for Exchangeable Image File Format. And this data has a lot of things in there, like what the f-stop was and the aperture and all the different kinds of things that go into taking the picture. But one of the other things that it has in here is the serial number of your camera. So if you're somewhere and somebody steals your camera or whatever, and you're like, darn, my camera's gone. You go home and you're bummed out and you're looking at all your pictures you took with the camera and remembering how great your camera was. Well, those pictures have information about your camera. And so all you really need to do is go to this stolencamera.com, and then you take one of your pictures that was taken with this camera, drag it into their little, you know, drag picture here, and it searches the EXIF information in the photo and then searches the web to see if anybody has posted any pictures taken with that camera.
Very cool. When it says searching the web, though, what what is involved there? That seems, are they doing like a Google image search? Are they?
They're doing an exif search of the images being posted on the web. And so that's how they're doing it. So
right.
They probably have their own crawlers going and running. Mm-hmm. Of course, my first thought is whenever I put images on the web, as in even all those hosting sites, they actually strip out all the exif info.
Sometimes they do, but then there's another thing you got to think about too, is that not all cameras are supported. Because I tried it with my iPhone, it just doesn't support the iPhone. So that's technically a phone, but it wouldn't support photos taken with the iPhone.
So the iPhone doesn't have the serial number of the device on it. It does have not geolocation.
Yes, it does, but it doesn't have the that information in the photo. It also doesn't support RAW photos, which would bum Alex and I out because we shoot a lot of RAW. but other than that, you know, just your standard, you go out, you buy a Canon, you know, point and shoot, all those kind of things. You know, they're a few hundred dollars, 500, you know, all that kind of stuff. You can just go here and it's a kind of a neat idea and it's free. So it's called stolencamerafinder.com.
Yeah, although shooting, not supporting RAW is not a big deal because I think very few people would bother to upload RAW files to a website.
But when you convert a RAW file to a JPEG, a lot of times you lose your data.
Correct, yeah.
You know, your exif data. Anyway. So it's so since we shoot RAW, even though we converted our photos to JPEGs, it wouldn't help us.
Right.
And the security arms race continues. Speaking of which.
Well, kind of along those lines, a while back I had brought up a story where Canon had had an image authentication system so that, you know, you take a picture with the camera. It was usually only their high-end camera supported this. And it would use cryptography to kind of sign that image so that later you can then verify, is this picture really what the camera took? Well, back then, a Russian hacker actually found a way to get the encryption key off of the camera and ended up actually taking an image that was originally Americans on the moon and put up a Russian flag, you know, fraudulently signed it and said, look, Canon says that this is a real image. Well, it seems that Nikon's similar image authentication system is compromised as well. So you really can't trust anything you see in images these days.
Especially if it's on the internet.
Of course, you really have never been able to. Even in the film days, there's always been ways to fake it.
Yeah. Although, wasn't it Star Wars that really made that change? Beforehand, you could kind of tell when the special effects were going on. Star Wars was a...
I thought those spaceships were real.
They are, Al. They are.
Well, you really could trace, you know, the falsification of images way back into the 1800s, but it goes way back.
Oh, well, okay then.
I've got something kind of related to this photo stream doing, so I'm going to just jump in here. But for the past few years, GigaPan team at Carnegie Mellon University has been making it possible to explore really great panoramic photos. This week they released something called Time Machine, which brings that technology that they've been using into video using HTML5 and modern browser technology. So it works really well on Google Chrome, and you can zoom in and pan around to, you know, watch a garden grow, for example, and you can zoom into the time-lapse video so close that you can see like bug bites on the leaves. It's pretty
wow.
Amazing. And I'll post a link to the site, but yeah, it's good stuff. Nice technology.
Nice. Laurel.
I got to say, I actually have some news on the royal wedding.
Oh, no.
It's just unavoidable. I have to say that there is a way to be a geek and engage with the royal wedding. And, of course, that's to take advantage of all of the fantastic sources out there. So if you still got that royal wedding fever, if you're not over it, you want to relive those beautiful moments, there are a billion royal wedding portals out there, including things like YouTube has a royal channel for all sorts of fantastic replay videos of the event. Of course, there's a Facebook page for the royals, allowing you to share your story.
I just have to say, this is a really interesting thing to me, that we're in the U.S., so everyone here is a U.S. citizen, and we're talking about the royal wedding, and everyone, actually, news organizations all around the U.S. Didn't we fight a war so we didn't have to worry about royal weddings anymore? I'm just curious.
You know, you got to take the good with the bad, because even though we don't agree with all this. There are some things that we like about it, but then we're also kind of, I'm kind of bummed out because this royal wedding with the kings and all this stuff over there and the queen, you know, how come there were no jesters? There were no jesters, and I was expecting some jousting knights, and there were no jousting knights. So if they're going to have some royal thing, why don't they do some castle stuff, some jesters, you know, some entertainment?
Al, it sounds like you actually watched this.
Well, I was hoping to see some funny gestures.
Juggling, watching it for the gestures.
Juggling is cool, you know?
The royal wedding.
You know what else is cool? Tattoos.
Yes.
Which, I like the one on your forehead.
Which brings me to my next subject. Tattoos are becoming more and more popular nowadays. I was reading a thing on the web, and this was from Britain, and which we're the wedding, and I guess, yeah, we planned all these connections. They say, like, what is it, 30% of the people in the UK have tattoos now? No, a fifth of all British adults have tattoos, is what they're saying. Well, there's a guy who is at the at the University College London, and he published details of a model in Mathematics Today, and the what this model does is it figures out what your tattoo is going to look like in 10 years. It's a mathematical model that uses the way that dye moves over time within skin to predict the blurriness and fading of the tattoo, because, you know, when you get a tattoo and it's all sharp and nice and everything, it doesn't stay that way. And they've got pictures of people. They used Victoria Beckham's foot tattoo just to show what it's going to look like in 10 years. She's got this, like, writing down her spine. Mm-hmm. And it's just this all blurry, like, you know, weird-looking fuzzy thing, you know, it goes down. And you know, it's...
No, this makes me wonder, though, is we use this mathematical model to show how it would go. Is it really that much better than just doing a Gaussian blur on the person's back?
Well, yeah, I think it's probably similar. And also he takes into consideration the type of dye used and the person's skin type. But
the skin's elasticity decreasing as well, so you see like the flabbiness.
Well, he says it depends on the location of the tattoo and the exposure of the tattoo to the sun. So those things influence the dispersion rate. But and he says, you know, obviously if you have like real big blocky tattoos, last longer than if you have tattoos that have a lot of fine detail. They're just going to just turn into this like inky blob eventually.
So now we can actually plan for, you know, how we're going to look in the rest homes when we're 70, 80.
Yeah, yeah, you're going to look like this. And we'll put a link to this on geekspeak.org. This was a link from The Guardian. Guardian.co.uk.
It sounds like they might have missed a main factor there, which is the likely ability to put on weight for a certain amount of years.
Yeah, really.
Percentage-wise.
Yeah.
They've got to add it in.
So, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. I feel really bad because I cut off Laura before she got to the crux of her story.
Oh, no. It was just kind of juicy, geeky stuff about make sure you follow the royal family on Twitter and that kind of thing. and they've got this cute shot of Twitter preparing for the deluge of information that's going to hit their servers when everybody's chatting about the royal wedding. And I thought it was really cute that the royal wedding hashtag is RW2011, you know, as if there's going to be like a repeat or a, you know.
Which is funny because Twitter went down as well.
Mm-hmm. Apparently they didn't prepare well
enough.
One
server, not enough.
Well, it's not like Twitter has the greatest uptime anyway, but then again, how important are those tweets?
Yeah. I would be pretty disappointed if I didn't get my royal wedding tweet.
We know that about you.
Alex.
All right. So kind of shifting gears here a little bit. Again, a while back, I brought up a story. This was about a botnet called CoreFlood.
A botnet is
basically where you have malware, viruses, things like that get into your computer and basically use your computer for bad things, sending spam, attacking systems, snooping on your data, your information.
So once again, folks, you get antivirus and you update your system not because you might have something valuable on your computer, but because other people have valuable things on their computers.
Yeah, exactly. And in some cases, you know, even doing wire transfer fraud, which is one of the things CoreFlood's actually been known to do. Well, it seems the DOJ has actually gotten permission to attack the botnet. The way that they're kind of doing it is something similar to that I've actually looked at. Is there is when the botnets, like you're basically an infected computer, the bot that's on your computer is effectively phones home periodically to get new instructions.
Your computer is a zombie now.
Right. It phones home to get like updates and stuff like that. Well, if you intercept that request to get its update, there's a command for the Core Flood network that's called uninstall. Literally, just say uninstall, and it cleans itself out of the system. Rather well, actually. There's some concerns the DOJ is going to be doing this on a lot of computers. There'll be permission, they'll be notified, all that sort of thing. But they're trying to basically just cripple this botnet because of how bad it has been.
Right. The issue in the past has always been if you are changing someone's computer without their explicit permission, that means that you're basically committing a tort. You're affecting someone else's property without their permission.
Correct.
So this is now changing. This is now saying
this is where they actually seek out the permission to proceed, but they are going to be doing notifications and getting permission still in advance. But they're not just like doing this where people just aren't going to know.
So which court gave them this permission? I'm curious.
I have not actually dug into that aspect of it.
Is it like the DC Court of Appeals?
I'll have the article a couple articles that I had gotten through that refer to this, and you can read more detail on geekspeak.org.
Okay.
I've got something kind of not end related.
Please.
Have a couple seconds. So the Army, excuse me, is coming up with an app store for war. Have you heard about this at all?
Excellent.
Yeah.
The app store for war.
But
I'd like an AK-47 with a banana clip.
You can custom order straight from the manufacturer.
There's
an
app for that.
Yeah. So the Army's going to be launching its version of an app store where soldiers can download Army-relevant software to their computers. And the big thing that it was originally designed
for... Oh, so you're not able to download an AK-47.
Sorry,
rats.
No. And have your MakerBot make it for you right on your desktop.
You can download the AK-47, but the ammunition is an update.
Oh, it's an in-app
purchase.
You have
to pay. The AK-47 is free.
Yeah, for your virtual war.
So it's freemium.
Yes.
For your future virtual wars, you can download your AK-47.
If they're not careful, Apple might sue them like they're suing Amazon for the title of App Store.
App Store, right. Oh, that's where we're going to go. All right. Well, they want to have this working on mobile phones eventually. It's going to be called Army Marketplace, so I think they're pretty safe, Alex.
All right.
It's going to start off featuring a few dozen apps that soldiers created last year during the Apps for the Army contest. There are things like workout guides, digitized manuals for Army tasks, and things like that so far. There's 17 apps for Android phones and 16 for iPhones so far. They can use the interface to share app ideas, like a soldier could post a description of what she needs on Marketplace Forum and then start a discussion between fellow soldiers and then potentially attract designers. And the designers would bid, like they would for contracts and stuff like that in order to create the app. In order to have access, though, of course, you have to be a member of the Department of Defense community. So, there's other sites that people are, that are portals that they would be able to have login for this if they have a login for another portal, et cetera.
We'll see how long that stays up with regard to DEF CON.
Right, exactly, the DOD site. But the big thing is they're having trouble getting permission to have a hardware phone approved to run the app. And so right now it's only available on, it's only going to be available for their desktops, but it's kind of designed to be a mobile app. So they're stuck up in bureaucracy. So the court thing reminded me about that.
Their desktops, their Windows desktops, their Mac desktops, or?
That's an excellent question, Miles. I don't know. Whichever are the NIST and DOD approved desktops for them.
Well, are there any, I'm trying to think of which operating systems had C2 level security. Last one I remembered was NT 4.0.
They're probably still using it.
There's actually an Android.
Well, actually, I think it's 3.5.1 was the last one to have that. 4.0, I don't know if it went through that because they. Anyway, that getting into Arcana.
There are a couple versions of Google OS that have been, that open OSs that have been approved, but that they're using internally, but I'm not sure exactly which ones. It mentions in the article I posted.
Okay. Well, thank you for that story. Laurel, your next story.
So I got to say, I have a love-hate relationship with Facebook.
Don't we all?
I use it as part of my job to do social media marketing. So yes, I am a little bit evil. But it's nice to see another way to use Facebook. We've got Conan O'Brien, who social media has been so very, very good to him. He has a series of videos now that you can post to your friend's wall. So you go to Team Coco, you like Conan O'Brien, and then you can send your friends F cards. I have no idea what the F stands for. Where he sort of points out the little idiosyncrasies of people who use Facebook. So if you're on Facebook, if you have to be on it or you choose to be on it, go ahead and like Team Coco, and you can check out his lovely little videos wishing good things to your friends.
That's wonderful.
Yay. I'll send you an F card today, Laurel.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, the record for likes has just been set. It's related.
Yes, it absolutely is.
We're all planning this out here. Frito-Lay, apparently, has set the Guinness record for Facebook likes. They had some sort of promotion, and they did it on their Facebook page. They did it, and it wasn't for liking the company. It was for liking the product. I think other companies have tried this. Oreo, basically they build a whole page. Do you like this page? And what Frito-Lay did was they said, do you like this product? Not their whole site. And they apparently have the record now for the most likes ever, ever made. But you know, the funny thing that I noticed is this record didn't exist before. So it's like, you know, yes, it's the most, but there was nobody else that had ever done it. They also partnered with Zynga's Farmville.
This thing seems so questionable to me, just because when I think of a Guinness record, it would be like, how fast can you juggle 10 cups? You know,
it's the most likes in a 24-hour period.
No, I get that, except that if you were, say, juggling cups, then there is a physical object that, and there are physical laws associated with it that are a limiting factor. Facebook determines how easily the likes are attainable. And like placement of ads or like blasts that come on, like when you go to the front page, like some information that may come up. So it doesn't seem to me like it doesn't seem to be rooted in the physical world. It seems very much they can change.
Well, I think also it has to do with the fact that the people who control, you know, or heavily influence how the likes work, which is Facebook, are not the ones being attributed for this reward, you know. So it's, you're basically saying, yeah, you did this great, but you really owe thanks, you know, Facebook for their thanks for that.
Well, we all agree it's complete nonsense.
Yeah.
but the number of likes that they got was 1,570,000 in that 24-hour period. So that was of interest. And, of course, we all know that Charlie Sheen set the record for the Twitter as the fastest person to reach 1 million followers.
Hmm. I did not know that. Thank you, Alan.
My life is richer.
Yeah, this all fits into marketing very well. And I just want to say, search for marketing Bill Hicks on YouTube.
Yes.
There's my little geek bit for the middle. But speaking of geek bits, we will have some more geek bits right after this break, because we want to mention that Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support for businesses. Tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. And KOSP co-sponsors the 10th Annual Santa Cruz Film Festival, May 5th. Through the 14th, showcasing 165 films from 33 countries. The opening night feature is Prairie Love, a dark comedy set on the snow-covered plains of North Dakota. Program and ticket information online at santacruzfilmfestival.org. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, and a geek bit, Al.
Oh, you want a geek bit?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, there...
I'm not the only one.
Yes. Okay. There is an app out there that calculates the calories of your food by taking a picture of it.
Really?
Yes, and I bought the app, and I tried it with a bowl of potato chips. And it did seem, well, I don't really know exactly what the bowl of potato chips was, but it's called Meal Snap, and it's getting good reviews. Like, if you look at the reviews, I always read them, and, you know, anything that's really short review, it's an iPhone app. Anything that's a short review is usually somebody's trying to promote the app, you know. But, you know, it's a whole bunch of good ones, so you just ignore those. But the longer ones, and they aren't full five-star ones, then, you know, they make sense. And people are saying this is a good idea. So basically what you do is you just take a picture of your food, and then you hit upload, and it comes back with a calorie count. And you know, I went through their website trying to figure out how they're doing this. I don't know how they're doing it. They say you could put a caption in, say, this is potato chips, or this is a Coke and pretzels or whatever. But I don't know how they're doing it, but somehow they're calculating the calories in from the photo.
Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Well, this is called Meal Snap, and I believe it may be using magic, and I can't confirm whether it's black magic or good magic. So
I've actually tried it, and I tried it with a very sort of complex looking meal with eggs and bacon and a cup of coffee, and it actually both captioned it correctly and also correctly identified
weird.
The calorie count.
That's just weird. We're like living in the future right now. This is the future.
And when a geek can't figure out how it works, stand back.
Yes.
Oh, there's a lot of things in technology that I don't know how it works.
Like my dishwasher is like that. I can't
my web
it.
Browser.
Yeah.
There's hope, people. There really is hope.
Yeah.
And I'm a web developer. I have no idea how a lot of things in the web browser actually work. I know that they work. I know what they do for me. But how they get it done, how they get JavaScript to run that fast, how they get the page to render that fast, I have no idea.
Magic. There are degrees of interest in geekdom.
Good point.
I guess I'm more along the lines of the biology spectrum, and the folks that are working on the browsers are more on the theoretical physics spectrum of sciences, even though they're related. Also for geekiness, I'm going to put up on the show an Ode to the Brain, a couple of videos, Ode to the Brain and 3D Labyrinth. You know those labyrinths, the marble you put down, you turn the little knobs and it goes.
Right, those wooden ones.
Yes. There is a 3D version of that that looks like a big gyroscope. And so you can see the video on that about a half hour after the show is over on geekspeak.org. Once again, in the air room with me are Al Luckow, Lindsay Klein, Alex Slias, Lindsay Lonnie.
Laurel Lonnie and Lindsay Klein.
Yes.
Ba-dum-bum.
Always used to laugh at live whenever we did that with John Tracy and Sean Cleveland.
Now we get to laugh at you.
Now you get to laugh at me. Any other geek bits just to run across?
No geek bit.
We are not taking calls today. One, we have a full house. And two, more pertinently, we don't have anyone to answer the phones because Rick Philman is off on vacation, and we hope he's having a good time. Next up, who did the last story?
Me.
I actually lost track. So, Alex.
All right. Well, I have a quick question to go around the geeks. Who here actually uses Netflix or has a subscription with Netflix?
I do.
I can quit anytime I want.
Right.
I don't have a problem.
So that accounts everyone in this room.
I can't because someone would kill me.
So everybody in this room uses Netflix. So apparently about 7% of all Americans actually subscribe to Netflix.
7%.
Oh,
7%. 70, okay,
sorry. No. 7%.
Just make sure the numbers are correct.
However, that bumps Netflix up above Comcast as the largest subscription media provider in terms of their subscription base.
Interesting.
Wow. So impressive.
They're big now.
I wonder how that's going to go now that Amazon is offering the service.
Yeah, and what is considered a media provider? Is that only streaming or?
I don't know.
Because Amazon sells a whole lot of media.
Because they don't.
I think it's particularly entertainment media. I mean, movies and stuff like that.
Oh, I guess Amazon is also.
They're comparing it to Comcast.
Right, the subscription model. Yeah, the subscription-based one.
It's amazing how fast they've grown. I mean, if you look at their place over in Los Gatos, because I'm in a startup near there, and they're like buying the whole building that we have to like move out of that building because Netflix is just that huge complex, just gigantic, and they're just growing. And what's really funny is I remember working in Los Gatos in around the turn of the century, and I remember the day that Netflix went public, and I just went to the local, you know, hamburger place, and I'm sitting there, and a bunch of those Netflix guys came in. They're like, "Whoa!" They're all shouting and everything. And
those uncouth Netflix guys.
I'm like, if only I said, "You guys are probably happy," and they're like, "Yeah, you know." And so if only I had bought stock right then.
Yeah, actually, just to clarify, the term media provider was actually mine. The way the article worded it was the biggest provider of subscription video content, specifically.
That makes, yeah,
and they basically, Netflix in the last year has grown 70%.
Wow.
They are growing fast.
It's a great service.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. If I start a business tomorrow, it will have grown an infinite percent.
Yes, but you have 7% of the population as your customer base.
Yeah. Details.
Because then you're even like my new best friend. But
Bestest.
And Lindsay.
All right, I'll switch into some space news here. I've got a couple different things. A little bit of sadness and then a little bit of happiness to finish it off. SETI Scope Suspends Search is the title of this one. Basically, last Friday, SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, sent out a letter to its donors explaining that the Allen Telescope Array would be going into a period of, quote, hibernation because of budget. So the shutdown means that observations will cease while officials look to raise $5 million to cover the next 2 years of the Kepler search. And for those that don't know, the Allen Array is a set of radio dishes that SETI runs in partnership with the University of California, Berkeley. It was built originally with $13.5 million donation from Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. And it started in 2007 and consists of about 42 large radio dishes. But the future plans call for a 350-dish array.
So. And SETI is...
the search for extraterrestrial signal. I don't know.
Search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
And they're turning it off because they can't afford to keep it going.
Right. I think Which means that if ET phones are home, no one will answer.
We should have a moment of silence.
We don't even have an answering machine.
We should have a moment of silence for the SETI.
Shh. Okay. Yeah.
But speaking of space, actually it reminds me of a story that I was reading recently. It was talking about the fact that in the foreseeable future, we will be able to go faster than we ever have before, which means that we'll be able to overtake the probes that are furthest from our solar system eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, we'll be able to do better than we did in the 60s and the 70s. So things like Pioneer 10, Voyager 1 and 2, like we would be able to get spacecraft that would be able to go so much faster that we would overtake them. And then, you know, what's the point if we can go that much faster than them? And the gold records that exist on them, gold because gold doesn't corrode, and that has basically, it's a record that has audio recordings, so you can hear what our world sounds like, what we sound like. It has information in it about, for example, our number system, letting, you know, an intelligent species know, oh, yeah, they know what prime numbers are, they know what pi is. Oh, okay, they can. And the supposition that these would become collector's items, or like these would be things like that would be worth, you know, far more than the Hope Diamond. In,
wow. Well, didn't you see
2000 in the year 2500? You know, Buck Rogers is going to be like, hey, that's a. I remember that.
You're going to get space pirates out there searching for these things and selling them on the black market.
Well, didn't you see that one movie where that was the whole reason? What was it? It was the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
No.
Did you see the end of that movie?
I haven't heard of that.
Actually, I never saw the movie.
Really?
I never saw the movie. I've read the books, but...
Don't see the movie. It would totally taint it.
That's what people told me, so I never got around to it.
Mm. You know, speaking of gold records, you know that Voyager is about to enter interstellar space?
Yes, it is just... it has reached the heliopause?
Sphere. Yep.
There you go.
Heliosphere.
Well, the heliopause is that point where the heliosphere meets interstellar space.
Ah.
It's that boundary point.
Okay.
At least I believe so. We may get someone angrily emailing us going, no, it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. Although the I guess the batteries for it are set to keep it going till about 2020. So it's going to be going for a while.
But it's going to be shooting off into
That's
massive nothingness.
Yes, it will. And so and who knows, think. After it passes the heliopause, maybe more difficult for us to get their signals as well.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they are going out past our solar system, they're not actually heading toward another star. The closest it'll get to another star is noticeably further than Voyager 2 is to us now.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of 2020, SpaceX posted a video of their Dragon program. You know, it's a marketing thing that they've put out there saying that they're going to be on Mars in 20 years. And it's a pretty interesting video. I'll post a link to it. But it's a promo video for a crew development program.
So I could see that in 20 years. I could see that.
So, you know, they'll be out there collecting the shuttle, taking photos, tourists.
Yeah, 20 years could be like fusion. Yeah, fusion will be there in 15 years. 15 years later, it'll be here in 15 years.
Right.
At the same time, think of where we were during World War II. And just a little bit more than 20 years later, we were on the moon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
so
amazing.
Who knows what 20 years can bring. Mm-hmm. Next story. Back to Al.
I have an interesting thing. This is sort of a small thing, but...
let's think about the sun's energy.
About the energy then. All right. What's the biggest problem with solar energy?
When there's no sun at nighttime.
Ah, but scientists have just developed, or they've just announced the development of a solar panel that works in the dark. And what this does, it's about time, right?
if a photovoltaic cell works by having photons hit it, and photons we normally associate with being from the sun, how does that work?
Well, what the scientists at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory announced on Wednesday, that they were able to confirm this new high-efficiency solar cell that uses the entire solar spectrum. So they figured out a way to basically make this thing work in the dark. And
the
it's not
entire solar spectrum.
Yes.
Okay.
And they actually say that this is and this is kind of thing has been done before. The problem is it's massively expensive to produce a thing that does this. I mean, there's this big spectrum out there. And what has really happened is that they've figured out a way to lower the production cost of the solar cell using gallium arsenide nitride. And somehow that makes it less expensive and able to be done. And it's not just that Lawrence Berkeley did it. They also did it at Ohio State University. So these things are going on. But now solar cells are, they're moving from something you only have in the day to something that you might be able to use.
Or at least do supplementary.
Right, yeah. Right. But that's kind of a neat thing. I mean, it's a cool thing, and it's coming, and they've actually confirmed the technology, and it looks like a very promising thing.
Yeah. I'm curious to see how well they can move this to production use, because there's also the longevity issues. You don't want to put a bunch of them, spend the money to put them on your roof only to find out that 4 years later, they're not working anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole thing is, it's not just a matter of coming up with the technology. It's making it affordable,
right,
so that you can install.
This is science. This mm-hmm. is not a – this is about saying what is possible. Mm-hmm. And that's what science is.
Right.
It's a philosophy of discovery.
Right.
So, yeah, I totally get that.
It's moving towards a commercial zone. And matter of fact, just as sort of related, they also have a material that can turn any metal surface into a – into a solar cell. It's photovoltaic spray paint.
Oh, nice.
And you're able to take this paint and spray it. And now this is more towards what you were saying, Miles, the scientific thing. They've got the material, but it's not a commercially available thing, but they've been able to prove it can be done.
Yeah, I could see how it would do the conversion, but how do you actually plug into that power?
How do you channel it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it has to be done on a metal – what they're saying is it has to be done on a metal plate.
Hmm. Still, I have the same question.
Steel sheets is what it requires.
So it just charges the metal that it's attached to, and then you have to basically drain it to a ground?
I guess.
Yeah, okay.
Photosensitive dyes.
Doesn't sound that
crazy. Yeah, I mean, and they were saying, you could take this kind of stuff and turn it into paint and put it on cars and make, your car can be charging, just all these like crazy ideas.
Reminds me of when I was looking at a new Prius, for example, as one of the possibilities. And one of the options was a solar panel on the top of the Prius. And I, along with many other people, were kind of looking at that going, that doesn't seem right, because if you're looking at the amount of current that you have to get from the hybrid battery and the amount of current that you can get from a panel that's about a meter square coming from the sun, it's kind of, just to put this into perspective, you'd be waiting 6 months before you could get your car a mile.
Wow. And it cost overhead just to buy that. I mean, to have that on your vehicle.
Well, no, there is a cost there. And the reason it exists is because if it would be a hot day, for example, it would run the cooling system so that your car would be kept at a reasonable temperature.
Could it even generate that much electricity?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just enough to vent
stuff out so that when you go back into your car, it's not an oven.
So you can run that little fan.
That's all it could do, huh? Right, just that whole solar cell.
Hey, you early adopters have got to pick this up so that, you know, it'll becomes cheaper for the rest of us.
Well, cheaper is one thing, but it's that whole, yeah, there's a thing called the solar constant. Alex, are you familiar?
No, I'm not.
The solar constant being the amount of energy that the sun actually gives to us. And that is, just to round off, it's about 1 kilowatt per square meter.
It's not really a constant, though, is it?
It's
solar flares, all this other
activity. When you're talking about solar power, it pretty much is. That's your base level, not counting any cloud overhead or temperature differential or whatnot. And so you're never going to get above that. It's impossible to get more energy out than you put in. Which actually made it very interesting to hear your story, Al, because once you start getting out of the visible spectrum, and you start getting into things like ultraviolet, and as you start going up the higher frequencies, they're more energetic. I wonder if you actually are able to get more power out of it.
Well, it's interesting.
As you start getting into more areas of the electromagnetic spectrum.
This article about the spray-on solar thing, which was done by the Swansea University in Wales, they're saying that they, you know, there's a lot of investment going into this, and the purpose, one of the things that they're mentioning is the paint can use this electricity to split water into hydrogen for oxygen for fuel cells. And so that's what they're saying. I don't know what the energy requirement is for something like that, but they're already investing in this stuff, and they've said the technology is already being... It's already proven.
Somewhere energy is being conserved.
Right.
In
that is
all I know.
Probably more plausible just because you can have very large arrays sitting around that are collecting the hydrogen there. At the same time, compressing that hydrogen to have it transportable even inside of a fuel cell seems like it would have a whole bunch of energy use.
Yeah, I
mean, solar power is pretty much free after you've paid for the photovoltaics, so that goes into it, but...
It's kind of like the solar panel where you're just trying to squeeze every last drop out of energy that you can get.
All right. I think we've got the story to death.
Well, to kind of stick to the idea of wonky science, or at least, you know, where we question it, there's apparently a chemical-free chemistry set. Actually, there's several out there.
There's one that's marketed as a chemical-free.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, there was a lot of people going, well, how do you have a chemical-free chemistry set? And, you know, if you even have water, you have chemicals, because H2O is a chemical compound. The big thing about this, though, in the articles that I was reading is it's a real big sign about the fears associated to it, to the whole idea of chemicals.
Right. We've talked about this before on the show, where since 9/11 and the crackdown for terrorism, they've cut down on some of the more volatile pieces of a chemistry set, a home chemistry set, except that you take those more volatile elements away and you don't really have a interesting chemistry set anymore.
Yep. Yeah, so it's interesting, though, because it's just there's a general trend where it's more driven by, you know, the parents who don't want to buy chemistry sets that have chemicals in them. So there's a lot of some of this pushes to get the marketing to kind of just say, well, parents, don't worry about this. These are not the chemicals you're looking for, you know.
Right. And and then, of course, we have to talk about the dangers of dihydrogen monoxide, which are very well documented.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They've been a lot of that discovered around here in the supply that, you know, comes to your faucet.
Kills millions of people every year.
Oh, yeah. Too much of it.
And too little.
Too little and too much. You've got to have the right amount.
That's right.
It's found in every body of water, every river. Mm-hmm.
There's probably some in this room.
It has contaminated the lines going to your house.
Yes.
And just for all those who this joke is kind of going over their head, dihydrogen monoxide would be dihydrogen, that's H2, monoxide. Oh, that's water.
Two hydrogen, one oxygen.
They did the thing. I saw like a joke thing, and they were asking people. You know, there was a protest against dihydrogen monoxide, and they had like a petition and getting people to sign they were against it. You know, and see how many people would walk up and sign it. And a lot of people, and they had them all on camera. Oh yes, this is. I'll sign this, you know, and it's really funny, is, you know, watching all these people.
Yeah, the best part about it, and fun little fact, is the whole dihydrogen monoxide, the website and the popularity that came along with it, was spawned by a UC Santa Cruz student.
Wow. Mm.
Back 10 years ago or something like that.
I'm not surprised.
And actually, another fun fact, a bureaucrat in Orange County saw this website, took it seriously, and was drafting legislation to ban its use in the municipalities that she had jurisdiction over.
Excellent.
And before it ever actually came to a vote or anything like that, someone kind of politely tapped her on the shoulder. But this is...
You don't know how far that really got, though.
Right. But this all actually comes down to what we were talking about, this fear of... You know, chemistry, this fear of the natural world, really what it comes down to. Because it's not even just any molecule, a chemical element, hydrogen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
the chemicals have been around, since the beginning of time. I mean,
right.
Chemicals are the notes that make up the symphony of life.
Oh, that's lovely.
And good thing we are here to bridge the gap, right?
Right. Now, definitely there are certain materials, compounds, shall we say, that are a little more dangerous and not necessarily as educational as, you know, one might think. But many of us believe that the pendulum has swung a little too far.
Yeah,
we need
to
come back to saying, yes, the only way that we're going to be completely without risk is to basically tell our kids, you can't learn anything.
Well, it's also confusing saying that, you know, these are not chemicals to a kid when you're handing them a chemistry set. You know, it's not really good to do.
Well, on the contrary, I don't know that it would be confusing to a kid that doesn't have any background in it. It would seem normal to them, and that is the danger.
Well, yes. I mean, it's confusing in that when they're going to learn that these are not chemicals, and then they're going to start being hitting conflicts as they learn more.
Right.
And that's going to be confusing.
It's that whole thing of, like, chemistry requires chemicals, and the world is chemicals. And just in the same way that you would have... I'm now drawing a blank. I was in mid-sentence. Oh, I'm getting old.
Must be
quick,
old.
Quick, distract the audience. Lindsay, your next story.
Sure. Did you know that Mac users are more educated but less Harley loving?
Hey, I disagree with that.
Right. That's kind of funny considering one of the geeks here is a Mac head
and a Harley rider.
So Hunch, which is the brain spawn of Flickr... A bunch of people, but Flickr founder Katarina Fake is one of the people behind Hunch, a site that, among other things, claims to personalize the internet by infusing her laptop with your body odor or something like that. I don't know, but interesting.
Just what I always wanted, a laptop with BO.
Yeah, just interesting ideas. But it took answers from 388,315 people and then cross-referenced the data with other questionnaires in order to cull vital computing information. So I'll just give you a list of some of the things that they came up with based on the statistics, and you can draw your own conclusions, but I'll post a link. But that was one of them, that Mac users are more educated and less Harley-loving. They're also 50%, Mac users are 50% more likely to frequently throw parties than PC users. Mac users are younger, slightly better at the verbal side of life, and the more educated thing. PC users would choose a Harley over a Vespa, whereas the reverse is true of those, you know, the sensitive Euro-leaning Mac types.
Right. Just as a correction, verbal skills are not actually correlated to education per se.
No.
That's
I think we should just add in the disclaimer, generally, correlation is not equal causation.
Yes. Yeah, do not buy a Mac and suddenly think, oh, I have a degree now.
And a Vespa.
Definitely don't buy a Mac and think you can't get that Harley.
Yeah. And the last one, that Mac users are apparently 21% more likely to believe they are computer savvy gearheads.
Yeah, along those lines, I don't know if it was the same report or if it's something similar, but also Mac users are significantly more liberal than their PC counterparts.
Yeah, all these fun statistics.
Lies, damn lies, lies, and yes. statistics.
I should just say that I have a PC, so, you know.
Ditto.
So do we have any burning stories that we need to get out before the end of the
show? Well, I have a PC-related one.
Go for it.
No, I mostly use Macs, but I also have a PC. And there's a kind of a cool thing that it's just a little bit of trivia. You know the desktop pattern on this is Windows XP. It's the most famous desktop pattern in the world. It's the sky and then that, like, green-like mm-hmm. area. You know that's an actual place?
And I had always assumed so. But
yeah, but it's like... A place, and somebody found this actual place, or they talked to the guy who took the picture. The photographer was Charles O'Rear, and he was a National Geographic photographer, and he took this picture. And I'm going to put a link to it on geekspeak.org. It's kind of cool because it shows you then and now. It shows you what it looks like now. it's like the exact same shot, but you know it's like all brownish now because I don't know. It's a different time of year, and there's no clouds. You know, it's not real beautiful, but it's kind of cool to think that's a place. And it's somewhere. He just took it with a regular old camera, not any great camera or anything, he said. And he was just driving up to Napa, and he just pulled over and took a picture, and that was it. And just ended up being the Windows desktop, most famous desktop in the world.
Nice. Yeah,
interesting. Actually, along with that, I'll throw up a link to pair with it. It was a really interesting series of photographs from all over Europe, modern pictures blended together with in Photoshop with images from World War II.
Ah, wonderful. Huh. Now, here's Al with Crazy USB of the Week.
Yes, there is a new thing that it's a USB key fob, you know, one of the little memory sticks. And what this does is it is in the shape of a film canister. So basically this company is making these little film. Remember the old film canisters that said, you know, you get 36 photos?
The little cylinders?
Yes. This is now they have these things that they're recycling these things. And they're using them for, USB memory sticks. And they hold a lot more than 36 photos. Yeah. This is, again, going to be another link on geekspeak.org. Which you can find all of our stories on geekspeak.org.
Yep.
So everything we've talked about, we get it up usually within 20 minutes or so or 30 minutes after the show. And you're able to go up there and just go look at all these fascinating stories that we've talked about, like Facebook likes and all of our neat little photo stuff. And
I don't know if that canister would fit on my computer.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Monterey County Atheist, a secular community group hosting a public celebration May 5th, 6:30 p.m. at Marina Library. More information at meetup.com/MCAtheist or 204-2290. Monterey County Atheist, a secular community group. Monterey Bay Green Gardener Certification Program is offering ocean-friendly landscaping classes on Saturdays in May at the Santa Cruz and Monterey Art Adult Schools. Registration is at the Santa Cruz Adult School at 319 La Fonda Avenue in Santa Cruz or the Monterey Adult School at 222 Casa Verde Way in Monterey. Information is at green-gardener.org. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Cruz.io Internet. Cruz.io powers broadband DSL and websites for thousands of local homes and businesses. Cruz.io Internet, technology for the next 20 years. More information online at cruz.io.com. Thank you, Al, Laurel, Alex, and Lindsay for joining me.
Thanks, Miles.
Thank you. Okay.
This has been GeekSpeak. Thank you so much for listening. The theme song today was done by Craig Strachan of South Africa.
Nice.
And thank him, and that's under Creative Commons. Your coming up now is Car Talk. Thank you for listening.